Governor Janet Mills answers your questions. When Janet Mills was sworn in as governor last year, no one could have predicted the challenges she'd face in office. The COVID-19 pandemic, with more than 100 Maine deaths and a devastating economic impact. Black Lives Matter protests and calls for systemic criminal justice reform. A major strike at Bath Iron Works. Thousands of cases of fraud in Maine's unemployment system. A controversial visit from President Trump, and more. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Maine's COVID positivity rate has finally fallen below 2%, but many are worried about another surge. And Maine's hospitality industry and hospitals both want a major bailout from the state. Governor Mills joins us today to talk about the pandemic, racial justice, the economy, and more. What are your questions? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we welcome Governor Janet Mills back to the program to discuss the fight against COVID-19, reopening the state, calls for racial justice, and to take your questions and comments. You can email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Governor Mills, thanks for joining us. And I'll start with this question. As we see surges in COVID-19 cases in states like Florida and Texas, are you concerned about Maine's pace of reopening? You have to have seen pictures from Wharf Street in downtown Portland on Friday night.
I did. Assuming those were legitimate photos, it was very, very disturbing. And we talked over the weekend about restricting that kind of gathering. I mean, it's a violation of the executive orders in many respects, and a violation of the businesses that are doing business in that way, because every business that opens, reopens, has to sign an acknowledgement of the checklist, the COVID-19 checklist, which also becomes part of their insurability as well, and a good business practice for a lot of reasons. So not just in compliance with the law, but in compliance with their insurance policies, and some city ordinances as well. Now, I was pleased when the city of Portland opened up some of the streets down the Old Port and elsewhere to allow restaurants and bars to serve outdoors, but to keep 6-foot distancing, keep seating arrangements that were COVID precautionary, taking all the other steps that are required in the checklist. But the photos we saw over the weekend were very disturbing, and I trust that will not occur again. I'm also concerned about what's happening in other states and the surge of tourists that is expected in Maine in the coming weeks and months. We generally see a flock of as many as 20 million people coming to Maine over the summer months, and we welcome them to come here as long as they stay safe and as long as they are safe. In other states, I was just on the phone for an hour and a half with the other governors and with Vice President Pence. Governor Abbott in Texas said that he was required, he just felt compelled to roll back the restaurant regulations from 75% capacity to 50% capacity and to close all the bars in Texas. He's also shutting down river rafting operations. And he says, he claims that this is all partly from the bars and restaurants, partly from Memorial Day celebrations. We're just seeing the impact of Memorial Day gatherings from several weeks ago, and that their positivity rate went from 4% to 14% just in the last several weeks since Memorial Day. So gatherings do matter. They make a difference, and they're very concerning. Small gatherings, big gatherings, anything over 50 people without 6-foot spacing distances, and people not respecting the mask protocols, these are very, very disturbing. Our positivity rate right now, I believe our 7-day rolling average is under 2%. 1.93 or something like that. So we're in a good place. We don't want to go back to a bad place. We don't want to ruin our record. And it takes the cooperation and patience of everybody in Maine and everybody coming to Maine to keep us safe.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Dr. Shaw has been talking for weeks about getting the positivity rate below 2%. We're finally there. If it goes higher, does Maine change its plan? Would you do like other governors have been doing and reset?
Resetting the restrictions is one of the potential acts. Licensing is another potential avenue of remedying a situation. If a particular activity or particular entity is not complying with the checklist, we can move to take their license if they have a business license in Maine or in the city, town where they operate. But we're looking for first and foremost for voluntary compliance, and by individuals, by visitors, staff, citizens of Maine, people of Maine, and the businesses, the hundreds of thousands of people who do business here every day. We want to make sure that they understand the risk and the need. People, you know, sort of north of Augusta have been kind of taking it easy in recent months, not taking it easy, but feeling they were less vulnerable because the numbers weren't there. But the numbers have been there. We just haven't been able to test everybody. And the outbreak, the small outbreak, the controlled, contained outbreak in Holton, I think opened everybody's eyes in Aroostook County, for instance, that this can happen anywhere. Anybody can come down with it anytime, anywhere.
Let me ask you about this. We are in the middle of what is traditionally Maine's tourism season. We're
right.
Hearing from people that there doesn't seem to be enforcement. There doesn't seem to be a lot of people following the rules. A friend of mine said, drove back to New Hampshire and back this morning, only saw two signs. One was kind of obscured, so the rules aren't really boldly out there, easy to read. Others, another friend in Booth Bay Harbor this past weekend, lots and lots of out-of-state plates. How can Maine people feel confident that those people with the out-of-state plates came in with a negative COVID test or have been quarantining?
I think we're trying to get the word out far and wide. We'll do the best we can. And frankly, there is only so much we can do, but I think the public in general knows what the rules are. We've tried to keep them fairly simple, unlike some other states where you're dictating restrictions based on the county that you come from and the varying and changing, ever-changing positivity rates of that particular county. We just say, hey, look, New Hampshire and Vermont, their caseloads and rates are pretty similar to Maine's. They're not a high-intensity state. But the other states people come from have been really high, high incidence states, most of them, if not all of them, higher than Maine's. And so we want to make sure that people coming here either quarantine for 14 days once they get here or have a negative test taken within 72 hours before they get here. If for some reason they can't possibly get a test before they get here, then get one when you get here. Testing is increasing day by day, test availability. And I jokingly said the other day on a call that maybe we could, and I actually texted Governor Sununu. I said, why don't we set up a good testing site right outside the liquor store in Portsmouth where everybody has to drive by to get to Maine anyway, you know. And he thought that wasn't a bad idea. But testing is available. And, yes, getting the word out is extremely important. We've got ads going up. We've got public relations materials going out. And stores and businesses have signs up about masking. And there will be more of that signage coming soon.
Yeah, speaking of Maine and New Hampshire and Vermont, there are those who are too worried that we're opening up too fast. Others are concerned that we're too restrictive, especially those who see tourists heading to New Hampshire and Vermont instead of Maine for summer vacations. Mm-hmm. Is it possible, Governor Mills, that you might align Maine's rules to at least be more consistent with the other New England states?
Well, they're quite different. New Hampshire and Vermont are different from, say, Massachusetts, which is still seeing a very high incidence of COVID-19, and they're just starting to open up restaurants and public establishments. We started that quite a while ago, and our rules are different than Rhode Island's and New York's, New Jersey, Connecticut's as well. But I stand by these rules because they are based on science. They are based on the public health considerations that we feel are first and foremost in what we do in terms of restrictions and changing and opening up our economy. I don't think you can have any higher priority than to save lives of people in Maine, people coming to Maine, people working in Maine. And you know what? That is the best economic program, too, to say, come to Maine, we are safe. We are a safe state. Can't guarantee that you won't get sick when you're here or that you're not bringing something with you, but for gosh sakes, we're taking every precaution we can. A negative test is one of the most important, I think, criteria we can impose, and we are imposing. Now, for instance, people say, oh, well, they can avoid it, they can do this, they can, you know, I guess you can thwart just about anything if you really want to, but why wouldn't you want to get tested? If you're traveling, and travel is down nationally and internationally, as you know, if you're traveling somewhere, why wouldn't you want to get a test? Why wouldn't you want to know whether you're carrying that virus or not? For your family's sake, your friend's sake, the relatives you may be visiting, the community you may be visiting, the businesses you may be shopping at, why wouldn't you want to know? If there's a reason people don't want to get tested, I'd like to know what it is. I have heard, on the other hand, I've received several messages from people who said, you know, I didn't like that test requirement when you first did it. I was kind of ticked off, you know. That seemed like an intrusion. But my husband got tested before he came home from Maryland, and lo and behold, he was positive. And thank God he was tested, because we have people in our household who are immunocompromised, who have vulnerabilities, who would have been put in great danger. And just this weekend, a young woman named Erica Smith wrote on Facebook very widely that her experience coming from Arizona, she got delayed getting the test results. She got tested in Arizona, came to Maine. It was some days after she got here when she got the results and found she was positive. And she was so regretful that she didn't wait. She didn't have any symptoms. She said it was a much easier process in Maine to get tested, and but found that she was positive and felt very bad that she put her parents and family members in a vulnerable position. So we're doing what we can. We can't put up barriers at the exits to the turnpike to say, give us your test results. But we're doing everything we can to make sure that people, you know before you go is actually the campaign. Know before you go, and keep everybody safe.
Governor Mills, I want to ask you about a couple other things. As you well know, the largest union at Bath Iron Works is on strike, a strike that's now entered its second week. This affects more than 4,000 Maine employees. The issue appears to be outsourcing of jobs. Have you spoken with leadership at General Dynamics to find a resolution to this strike? And what is your position on the outsourcing issue?
I don't think it'd be fair for me to take a position on the outsourcing issue at Bath Iron Works without knowing the particulars. And no, I have not called the management at Bath Iron Works. If management and the union leadership wish to have a meeting, you know, I've met with them in the past, not about this particular issue, but not recently. But I'd be happy to meet with them. Another alternative is mediation, something they might consider. But I have not gotten involved in the negotiations, and I'm not going to pass judgment one way or the other about the outsourcing of contract employment.
All right. Another topic that's so important to so many people, the Black Lives Matter protests that are calling for a systemic reform of the criminal justice system. You're a longtime part of that system as both a DA and state attorney general. Just last week on Maine Calling, Corrections Commissioner Randy Liberty told us that 11% of those incarcerated in the state prisons are Black, far out of proportion in a state with a 2% Black population. Do you believe the system is broken, and do you believe there is need for systemic change?
Well, thanks for the question. And by the way, I wasn't just a prosecutor in my many years as a lawyer. For 14 years, I was a defense attorney and in private practice doing all kinds of civil work as well. In fact, I was the president of the Maine Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers for several years. So I've seen both sides of criminal cases. I don't believe I come into this with a great bias one way or the other when it comes to that. But I'm very familiar with the criminal justice system, obviously. And last year, there was a study commenced by an outside contractor, consultant, into our criminal justice system with detailed data on the number of individuals of color in the criminal justice system, number of arrests, number of prosecutions, and what kinds of crimes and that kind of thing. And we're just digging into that, actually, in the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee was digging into that. earlier this year, and I'm looking forward to taking up that research again and trying to figure out why this is happening and what we can do to lift the burdens. It's not fair. If those statistics are found valid, which they appear to be, it's not right. And I think that one thing the recent protests have shown us is that to say I'm not a racist is just not enough. Being anti-racist is more than just saying I am not a racist. We have to all take a position about racism and make sure that the scourge of racism is eliminated from our society.
Do you support the calls to, quote unquote, defund the police and shift funding to more social service responders?
I don't think it's either or when it comes to funding police departments and funding social services agencies. You know, for the last year and a half, I think we've done a pretty good job of rebuilding some of the social services agencies that were defunded over the previous 8 years, and rebuilding the public health infrastructure at DHHS and CDC. And we've seen the success of that in the last 3 months during this pandemic. But we were just getting going. And Medicaid expansion was the first thing I did on day one, which is probably one of the biggest social services opportunities Maine has, is to fund health care for all people. And thank God we did that before this pandemic struck. Thank God 55,000 people, more people in Maine, have health care than had it before. So I'm glad for that. When it comes to police departments, you know, I've worked with small-town police officers and state police and city officers when I was a district attorney and a defense attorney. And I appreciate the work that they do. In many cases, in many respects, police officers end up serving as social services outreach people, referring people to services that they might need in times of crisis. And in recent years, we've provided a lot of mental health training through NAMI for police officers all across the state. It's become mandatory. But I've also looked at the Criminal Justice Board of Trustees minimum standards proposal for the use of force in hate or bias crimes, and I think they're on the right track there. Changing mandatory policies for all police departments regarding intervening when they see another officer using unreasonable or unnecessary force or discharging a firearm at a moving vehicle, that kind of thing. We do train in de-escalation techniques. I think that all police departments should be trained in de-escalation techniques and reducing excessive force. That's just a given. We have a hard time recruiting for all the police departments. You see that the Portland Police Department, I think, is offering, last I knew, it was like a $10,000 signing bonus. We want to recruit good people for these jobs because they are sensitive, and they are on the front lines of providing services to people in all kinds of cases in all times of need.
On that same topic, many are calling for an end to Maine's cash bail system, saying it's dysfunctional and unfairly penalizes people without means. Do you support elimination of the cash bail system in Maine?
Cash bail, I think, does serve a purpose. I've been on commissions before when I was district attorney and attorney general looking at the bail system in Maine. We made a lot of changes to the bail system a few years ago. I think you've got to have something. So in many cases where there's domestic violence, for instance, you've got to have something more than a promise to show up in court. Something more, a bigger commitment to avoid crime while you're out on bail. In many, many cases, statistically, are people who are in jail who've already been out on bail and violated bail conditions by committing new crimes, such as domestic violence, going back with your partner and harassing that person again. So those kinds of things, what option do you have? Another promise? I think the cash bail system is inherently unfair with respect to wealth, the disparity of people of means being able to post cash bail and people of no means not being able to. But we also have, in many parts of the state, alternatives of supervision. We have, options for people going out on supervision as if they were on probation, but prior to going to court. And I think those have been pretty successful too. where you're kind of accountable to somebody, and you have to show up, or you have to pass a urine test if you have a drug issue, that kind of thing. Those have been successful not only in reducing crime before a trial, but also reducing recidivism in general.
All right. And I want to ask you about Maine's lobster industry. If a lobster glut seems to be developing, are you willing to consider or take executive action to limit the harvest effort or timing to avert a market crash?
Boy, that's a big issue, big question, and I am not ready to consider that at this point. I just think the lobster industry is being hit from all sides for all kinds of reasons, and it's unfair what's happening to the lobster industry. Both the COVID-related reasons, influences, you know, the cruise ships are no longer ordering lobster. Cruise ships were a big supply, customer of the lobster industry. Tourism, we don't have a single Canadian coming across the border because the border is closed. You're not seeing, that's 17% of our tourism industry is people coming from Canada. They're not coming. They can't come. We're seeing fewer people traveling, and then we had the restaurants closed for a while. So restaurants coming back. So the market itself is a big problem for the lobster industry right now. But more importantly, the retaliatory tariffs from China, huge economic impact on our lobster industry. And then there's the whole issue of the whales. I mean, and that would take another hour and a half, but you know where I stand with that. I stand squarely with the lobstermen on the whales issue, right, whales issue. But so they're getting hit from all sides. I don't want to hit them while they're down. I wouldn't want to talk about closing any part of the fisheries at this point or changing the criteria, the lobster length or anything like that.
All right. Well, we do need to get to some of our audience questions. We'll do that after a break. This is Maine Calling, and we're talking with Governor Janet Mills.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from New England Cancer Specialists, committed to excellence and now a member of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative, newenglandcancerspecialists.org, and Sherman's Maine Coast Bookshops, now reopened in Bar Harbor, Damariscotta, Boothbay Harbor, Freeport, and Portland's Old Port.
Artist Nicholas Smith's portrait of George Floyd wearing a tuxedo and bow tie was meant to celebrate and mourn his life.
He's questioning, why did this happen to me? I want my art to show the world, like, this is a human being that lived on this earth and should still be living on this earth.
More on the activism in Smith's paintings of black heroes and victims of police brutality this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon between 4 and 6:30, right here on Maine Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Mark Vogelsang, President and CEO of Maine Public. 2020 has already proven to be an historic year. So many things are changing, and yet Maine Public Radio's commitment to serving you remains unwavering. The need for trusted news and information is as important now more than ever, which is why your support of independent journalism today is so critical. Please make a donation to support the news you trust at mainpublic.org today. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today on our program, Governor Janet Mills is our guest. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or go to our Facebook page. Please make your questions brief. We have so many questions coming. We're going to start with Kate, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Kate. Go ahead.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, my name's Kate. I live in Portland. And my question for Governor Mills is, I heard her say a few moments ago that we're in a good place with COVID-19 in Maine. And that really contrasts sharply with and erases the fact that Maine is reporting the worst racial disparities in the entire country for COVID cases. So I'm curious what the governor plans to do in response to Black, Wabanaki, and immigrant leaders who called during a press conference last week for her to address this crisis, including declaring it a public health emergency.
Thanks for the question, Kate. I just watched that press conference last night. It was an hour and 38 minutes long, so obviously I didn't have a chance to watch it on Thursday, but I understand some of the problems that we're looking at, and I have a better understanding of just the disparities in responding to COVID-19 among immigrant communities, for instance. And I think this is a very serious matter. I take it very seriously, and I know that Commissioner Lambrew does as well, and Dr. Shaw does as well. And to say we're working on it sounds insufficient, but we are working on it, and we want to do a better job at outreach. For instance, people who live in crowded quarters in Lewiston, as Sophia Khalid pointed out, who can't take time off from work to be quarantined in some hotel, and they don't even have the capacity to make a meal and be with their families and children. Those are serious issues. Transportation issues appear to be more concerning, more serious among some of the communities of color than elsewhere. So cultural barriers, we want to have cultural brokers, sort of ambassadors to deal with, taking down the barriers. And we want to make sure that nobody is afraid to have a test. One of the interesting things is the number of people of color working in the healthcare industry and the number of healthcare people who have been diagnosed with COVID-19. That's a serious matter we want to address. And people doing home healthcare work many of whom are people of color. They're exposed. They're an at-risk population. I want to make sure that everybody has all the protections they can that they need, that their families are cared for, and that Catholic Charities has a contract to reach out to people in a much more aggressive way, to employ cultural brokers, obviously people with language proficiency, and dealing with other provider agencies and the CAP agencies to make sure that everyone who is diagnosed with, who has a positive test, also is fully cooperative, as I assume they would be, in contact tracing. Once people understand what that's about, getting through the language barriers around those things is really important to all of us. So those are some of the things we're going to do.
Kate, thank you so much for your question. Governor Mills, we have a lot of questions coming in about masks. This is one from Pete on Twitter. I'm seeing an extreme lack of compliance for what I thought was a facial covering mandate. I've limited my forays into the public to the grocery store and hardware store. Plenty of folks not wearing masks. I'm seeing lots of out-of-state plates. With the governor's mandates, it doesn't appear there's any enforcement mechanism. It seems like mandates are solely operating under an honor system. Why have them at all? I am not interested in policing my fellow citizens on behalf of the state. Governor Mills, if there's one question that's coming in over and over and over again, it's this one. What is going on?
Well, you have it over me because I don't get out very much, so I don't get to see this with my own two eyes. But what I've observed in Farmington when I'm home is fairly positive. I just want to back up one second. The first person said there are a number of out-of-state plates. I don't think we want to judge anybody by the license plate of the car they're driving. There are a number of people who've come here to help us with health care and other emergency services who are driving rental cars or who have out-of-state plates. So I don't want to discriminate against them in any way. This is the time of year when people come here from other states to vacation, and we want to welcome them. We want them to be here. We also want more signage, more use of the masks. Even some of the states like Texas and Oklahoma and Florida, Arizona, who had been lifting restrictions rather rapidly, are now reimposing mask requirements and closing bars, et cetera. Everybody seems to recognize. And on the call just now with Vice President Pence and the 50 governors, Vice President Pence was asked point blank, will you and the president strongly recommend wearing masks? Will you change the message out there? Will you please get the message out there? And this was from a Republican governor of Utah who pressed the vice president, get people out, get the president out there saying you got to wear masks. And the vice president said he would work on that. I mean, he's actually come out and said, yeah, masks are the best thing we can do. And so is Dr. Fauci, Dr. Shah, Dr. Burks, and others. In terms of enforcement, I'd like to see more aggressive enforcement by the stores, by the retailers. We didn't put it on them to require it because they didn't want that burden, that enforcement burden. But we asked them, we told them to put signage up at the doors saying you got to wear a mask and limit customers, et cetera, et cetera. And most of what I've heard about is fairly good. I think the Hannafords and Shaws and the Walmarts and the stores that have been doing this now for a while are pretty good at enforcing capacity limits and telling people they should wear masks. We also gave them the authority to kick somebody out, to tell them to leave if they don't wear a mask. I can't tell you firsthand whether that's happening or not or to what degree it's happening. But I will be talking to the Retail Association and encouraging them to do more of those in that way. Public gatherings, a different thing. If you're expecting to be at a public gathering, presumably fewer than 50 people, you should still wear a mask. You should still conform to 6-foot distancing. And people are hiking around me. People are climbing mountains. People are going to the beach. There are a lot of public areas where you probably don't need a mask, but you should have one on you anyway, in case you meet up with a crowd.
A tweet here. I canceled all of my out-of-state summer renters to do the right thing and flatten the curve. Mm-hmm. It is a painful decision, and most of my annual income, plane tickets were canceled, and some renters were angry. Can I get any financial relief from the state? And this is one person asking a question that, as you well know, the entire hospitality industry mm-hmm. is asking for $800 million from the state.
Yeah. Yeah, these are tough. I don't know. There's no easy answer. There's no simple answer, and I appreciate the person's question. The entire hospitality industry or the organization has asked for $800 million out of the CARES relief money. The hospitals have asked for $120 million from the CARES relief money. I'm not sure how much the towns and cities are going to ask for, but I'm sure they'll be asking for hundreds of millions of dollars from it as well. We did use about $270 million of it so far to replenish the unemployment trust fund, which in turn supports 45,000 Maine businesses and about 607,000 Maine workers in Maine, so that we won't be raising unemployment taxes to pay for this the pandemic-related unemployment period. But the dictates the restrictions of that money from the Department of Treasury. There are certain things we can use it for, which we are using it for instance, the unemployment trust fund. Other things were just not clear at all. The FAQs and the guidelines change day to day, week to week. And they also say if you don't use the money the way only the way you're told to use it, you're going to have to pay it back. So I don't have the luxury of cutting checks as if it were my personal checkbook or anybody's checkbook and saying, this sounds like a good cause. We know that the nonprofits are losing money, too. There are all kinds of sectors of the economy who are losing money, and I cannot imagine running a B&B right now or Airbnb or a small hotel and having to suffer through this season. But what scares me more than anything, is somebody bringing this virus to Maine and an outbreak occurring in our most beautiful towns and resort areas like Booth Bay, or Bar Harbor, Ogunquit, Kennebunk, Greenville, Rangeley, etc. And if there's an outbreak and it spreads, our economy and their economy and the lives and health of Maine people are destined to be impaired for a good long time. People will not come back to Maine for years and years to come. That's the thing that keeps me awake nights. And the thing that keeps me awake nights is thinking about the resurgence in late summer, early fall that many public health professionals are talking about. So while it's extremely painful, and I love those towns, and I love going to the beaches, and I love going to the mountains and rivers in Maine, and I love greeting people from other states, but I want them to feel safe, and I want us all to be safe. That's the most important thing in my administration right now, keeping people safe. Will there be money to support some kind of relief program? I'm not sure. I'm working on Congress and speaking with all four of our congressional members of our congressional delegation. We're looking at a fourth relief program from Congress. Another one of the things that was the topic of the White House call this morning was to press the Vice President to get the President to sign off on another relief package that could be used specifically for relief for local governments and businesses and nonprofits.
Al on Facebook asks, Why is she keeping 32 young people locked up in cages at Long Creek Youth Development Center? The first reported case was announced yesterday. With an operating budget of $18 million, why aren't the youth giving housing and health care instead of incarceration?
I don't know if the gentleman's ever been to the Long Creek Youth Center, but there are no cages. People are not locked up in cages. It's more of a school environment, although obviously there's fencing and barriers around the establishment. And if there are 32 people in there now incarcerated because a judge has said they cannot make bail, should not make bail, or are detained for sentencing purposes, those are 32 individual decisions based on whatever crime that person may have committed. And their age and their propensity for recidivism and potential dangerousness to somebody else. So I can't speak to every one of those individuals. But I know that I think Commissioner Liberty has done a really good job. 32 is down from over 50 just a few months ago. We are trying to get more wraparound services for every one of these juveniles. Many of them don't have families to go home to. Many of them have no place to go. And I wish we had, you know, really well-run, sophisticated group homes in different parts of the state where these kids could find a home and a structure and some responsibility that will, you know, help them become responsible adults and good citizens of the state of Maine. That's my dream.
We have dozens of questions coming in. We're going to take another quick break and get to as many as we can. We're talking with Governor Janet Mills on Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from AARP Maine, highlighting the importance of high-speed internet for all Mainers. AARP.org/ME.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
Noted peace activist Samantha Smith was born on June 29, 1972 in Holton. In December 1982, when she was just 10 years old, Smith wrote a letter to the new leader of the Soviet Union, Yuri Andropov. She wrote to Andropov asking bluntly, "Are you going to vote to have a war or not? If you aren't, please tell me how you are going to help to not have a war." Andropov replied 4 months later, assuring her that he and the Soviet people wanted peace.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries and Maine Maritime Museum. Happy birthday, Maine!
The Daily Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus now has a new 3-day-a-week schedule, regularly meeting on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. On these 3 days, it will normally happen at 2 o'clock. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, the briefings are archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and others is now normally scheduled for 2, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday afternoons, and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling, and today we're talking with Governor Janet Mills. We're going to go to a call from Jennifer in South Paris. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to thank the governor for her swift action and keeping everyone safe. Having said that, I am a business owner, a very small family business that has been effectively shut down since the quarantine. And I'm really nervous. I don't know that I'll be able to sustain myself. And just looking for some, hopefully, financial relief at some point.
Governor.
Well, Jennifer, thank you for your patience. And it's thanks to people like you who have done what they should do, even though it's at a great loss to yourself and your business, that we are able to keep people safe. And we've got to stay the course. I don't know what kind of business you're in, but I appreciate that so many businesses are losing money all across the state and all across the country. And when you think about Maine's situation, we're kind of unique. We're, you know, two sides are covered by Canada, one side by New Hampshire. I'm sure you get a lot of traffic from New Hampshire if you're in South Paris. You're not getting the Canadian traffic. You're not getting people traveling because people aren't traveling as much as they used to or were last year. Consumer spending is way down, too. So I, too, am hopeful for an economic relief package from Congress. If the president signs off on one, there are four different packages sitting in the Senate right now, according to our two senators. And I think at least one of them, will have some prospect of passage. I don't know what the president's going to ask for in return. I'm not keen on the payroll taxes being abated either, but we'll see what he does, see what the Senate does. There's a tremendous amount of pressure because innocent people like you all over the state and all over the country are losing your shirts because of this recession, a pandemic-caused created recession that no one could have predicted, no one could have prepared for. So while there are things we can do sort of around the edges, like encouraging Congress to continue to tell Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to continue with forbearances on mortgages for federally insured loans, things of that sort. We can continue to provide some rent relief. We can continue to provide food and social services to people in need. But boy, it's going to be a long haul, and I wish I had better news. But by God, we got to keep the faith and stay safe.
Yeah, thanks for your question. Good luck to you and to your business. I have a tweet here from Tina. What is the response to the reported increase in overdoses since the beginning of COVID-19? How is the state planning to respond to the limited beds available for detox and inpatient treatment across the state? Talking about, of course, Maine's opioid epidemic. Governor.
Great question. And it concerns me greatly that there appears to be an increase in overdose deaths. Anecdotally, so far, it seems judging from Dr. Sorg's reports, that appears to be caused by higher intensity drugs, more dangerous high concentrations of fentanyl, extremely deadly doses of fentanyl out there in the communities. But there may be other causes as well, and we want to get to the bottom of it. I don't know about the bed situation. I know Gordon Smith has been working on that, and even remotely in his fashion, going around the state, canvassing to make sure there are beds available or beds slots available in the various facilities to take people who want help. It's a desperate situation, and I completely sympathize. You know, we're getting more and more Narcan out there. We have trained recovery counselors to be at the ready when someone calls from a hospital or any other place to help, you know, from a peer-to-peer standpoint or otherwise professional help by phone, increasing the helpline capacity, things of that sort. But boy, oh boy, it's a tough one, and I wish I had a better answer, a long-term answer, but we're working on it.
An email from Mark. This past week, I've been trying without success to find somewhere in Midcoast Maine, as well as Connecticut, that offers COVID testing to people who are not exhibiting symptoms. None of the test sites, nor my local doctor's office at Lincoln Health, will authorize such testing. You have to be exhibiting symptoms. Why are the doctors and the test sites out of step with the state? And Governor, what Mark is asking is something I have actually heard anecdotally from several people, that they want to do the right thing. They want to get a test either before they come to Maine or right when they come to Maine, or because they're traveling in the other direction. And unless they fib and they tell their doctor that they're feeling symptoms, they're not able to get that test.
Yeah, I've heard that anecdotally as well. Just this morning, somebody emailed me from Farmington and said that Franklin Memorial Hospital wouldn't do a test of this individual, even though they're going to be traveling, and they feel they're in a high-risk category because they're in sales. Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that our standing order that issued a couple weeks ago applies to people who are at risk, not just because they have symptoms. It's not limited to people who have symptoms. That would almost be too little too late, in a sense. So our standing order and our stand-up of tests and commercial tests across the state of Maine, some of which are federally funded, applies to anyone who, for instance, in the healthcare profession, a first responder, people who are in public-facing positions, that kind of thing, or people who are traveling to and from other states with higher incidence COVID-19 cases, that standing order may be misunderstood, and we'll make sure that it gets understood to be liberally construed, liberally used, and I'm in favor of as much testing as possible. There is a drugstore pharmacy on Forest Avenue that just opened up its testing, and I believe that it is free, and I believe it is open to anybody. There are testing facilities standing up all across the state of Maine every day, and we're going to make sure we get the word out that it should be widely used, and people should be able to get tested easily. I've been talking to the governors of New Hampshire and Vermont. They've got even greater testing capacity, commercial testing capacity. They can't get people to get tested. It's kind of interesting. People don't want to get tested there. Now here in Maine, we're hearing people who want to get tested and can't. I want to make sure we rectify that situation.
A tweet. It was easy for me to go online and request a mail-in ballot. I also requested one for my mother. What about older people who don't have internet or don't understand what they need to do? We need to send ballots requests to everyone with paid postage so everyone can safely vote.
Well, we have what we did by executive order because of the COVID-19 pandemic. We eliminated the we allowed absentee balloting right up to 8 p.m. on election day, and that's no excuse absentee balloting. The person's mother can call the town clerk and ask for a ballot to be mailed to the person's mother. The person's mother can do that herself, and it doesn't have to be by email or internet. And she can receive a ballot by mail and turn around and send it back in or drop it off at the clerk's office. Those are fairly simple procedures. We're not at a place right now where we're going to mail ballots to everybody, you know, sight unseen. That's not allowed by state law, and I don't think I can change that by executive order. At this point, I don't think that'd be right, but some states are looking at that. I think we've got 130-something thousand absentee ballot requests out right now. That's pretty significant. Huge numbers of absentee ballot requests, and I'm happy about that because the last thing we want to see is a long line at the polling places on July 14th and burdening the clerks and their staff and the volunteers who work at the polls on election day and expose them to members of the public who might be carrying the virus and expose other voters to people who might be carrying the virus. So I'm glad that there's a big demand for absentee ballots right now.
An email from Lisa. Do you see any relief for the many Mainers that have been waiting for their unemployment payments to be issued for weeks and months? For example, I have not been paid in 4 weeks. The payments are languishing and she has quotes here, processed. And I know many families have it worse than I do. I typically can't get an answer from the DOL for weeks, and when and if I do, I'm told I'll look into it, which sadly doesn't put money in our bank account or mm-hmm. food on our table.
Mm-hmm. On behalf of state government and all state governments across the country, I apologize to her because there have been so many problems with the unemployment systems across the country, and now we're seeing fraudulent claims. I think we had something like 25,000 imposter fraud cases so far, and 41,000 weekly certifications that were fraudulent. So we had Laura Fortman, Commissioner Fortman, had to put things on pause for a couple of days while we ferreted out the fraudulent claims. But that's no excuse for her not to get her check in 4 weeks. I apologize to you. And we're trying to make it happen. We're trying to get people's claims processed as quickly as possible. There's at the federal level and the state level, there are bureaucratic reasons why things don't get done as quickly as we want them to get done, especially with the new state laws and new federal laws, one on top of the other, that require somebody to apply for this before you apply for that, and a computer system that was set up 3 or 4 years ago that does not seem to be adequate to process this kind of volume, frankly. But I'm sorry she's having to wait, and we will try to do better. The state of Vermont, I know, issued payments to people, sort of everybody who applied, and we determined we couldn't do that under the federal law. And the federal government was very clear about that. So short of doing that, there's not much we can do except to. We have hired over 100 new people to do claims processing and fact-finding meetings, sessions, and we hope that that'll speed up the process as well.
All right, a little less than a minute left, but I'll do this email from Barbara because I'll go to the email from Barbara because several people have similar emails. Mm-hmm. Does Governor Mills think schools will be able to have students return physically to school this fall?
Pender-Macon is all over that. We definitely want to reintegrate kids back into classroom instruction. There may be different ways of doing that physically in different areas, different regions of the state, but she's working with the superintendents, school boards, and teachers, and the MEA across the state in making that happen. So barring any crazy thing, barring any great resurgence of the virus, which we cross our fingers and hope against, we will open schools in the fall. Let's hope for. On another note, just let me say, July 14th is also the day we get to vote on the bond questions, and number one bond, which is broadband, $15 million for broadband. Mm. Given the state of instruction in the last few months, we know it's more important than ever that we expand broadband in Maine. And I guess that's all I hear, the bell. So school bell ringing me out.
Well, Governor Mills, we acknowledge the incredibly difficult decisions you're facing right now. And thank you so much for your time this hour on Maine Calling, and hope to have you back soon. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Dr. Shaw's CDC briefing is coming up in just a few minutes here on Maine Public Radio, as well as television and on the internet. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.